Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayikra. The Executive Learning Seminar is headed towards us. This year will be the 17th year of the seminar, and it will be held June 29th through July 3rd in Jerusalem at Pardes. This year we will be focusing on one of the most influential figures of the 20th century, Rav Kook, examining writings that open up the burning issues of his day and trying to understand why he has such a continued impact upon Israel and the diaspora today. There'll be 5 days of grappling with ancient texts and current issues, visiting historical sites, and learning from some of the best educators Israel has to offer. I hope you decide to join us in Jerusalem, June 29th through July 3rd. All the details are available at pardes.org.il/executive. This week, Rabbi Daniel Landis discusses Vayikra and Purim, the Megillah of Esther. Rabbi Daniel Landis is the director of the Pardes Institute. And now, Rabbi Daniel Landis.
And a wonderful Purim and Purim month to you, Larry. Today I've decided, as we're well into Adar Bet, to talk a little bit about the Megillah. I want to take a particular direction, and that is what Jews need to know, what Jews are taught in this post-God book. And I say post-God, I believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu 100%. But this stage of God's career for us is in which God's name is not even mentioned. So what are Jews supposed to do? How are they supposed to come into a secular civilization and survive, and not just survive, but survive well? So I'm kind of interested in the questions of what Jews, first of all, can't they do? Or how they deceive themselves? And what Jews can do and what Jews should do. And part of my inspiration for this is that yesterday, in the midst of a great dust storm, terrible dust storm in Jerusalem, there was a protest demonstration by the Haredi ultra-Orthodox community against the draft law or equalization of the burden law, burden of keeping Jewish society, Israel society together in terms of military service and all that implies. And the demonstration, which I have to say was called by one of its founders, a great rabbi, as a tzer tefillah, as a convocation of prayer. And indeed, it was prayer. And there, as far as I know, there are no real speeches and no real rabble-rousing. It was peaceful, a large number of people. The organizers claim 500,000 for the million men march. Catch the notion, men. Although women were also provided for a certain place, space, and it was peaceful. I mean, there's always some disruption given the nature of things and given the nature of amounts of people. There were actually 300,000, the police say, but nonetheless impressive in that regard. And prayer opportunities should be available in Israel. Nonetheless, it provided me with some thought. Let me go to my original question, and I'll try to put all this together. What Jews and what the Megillah tells us. I said the Megillah was this kind of, I don't want to say that word anymore, post-God book, but post-godly book. Kind of almost a secular book. A book that really deals with harsh realities, life and death. What does it mean to be surrounded by enemies? What does it mean? How do we respond to terrible situations? And the book tells us, in fact, the first thing the book tells us is you have to know history. It's like an instruction manual, how Jews should behave. You have to know history. Very unusual book of the Bible in which it begins with the secular history. It begins with what's happening to Ahasuerus and the kingdom and his career and all these things which are in some way transitory. They're transitory in terms of eternity, but they're not transitory in terms of the moment. And it teaches us you have to know what's going on in the moment. as begins his life, and actually even his very intimate life with his wife, that public nature of that, because all intimacy deals with politics, has a public nature as well. The people who get ahead and go ahead, and the private life of a Jew, Mordechai, an exilee, a person who struggles very hard to rebuild his life, and places himself in the midst of society. And I say that from the following notion. He placed himself in the midst of society. His name, Mordechai, which today, of course, is obviously very Jewish, is a non-Jewish name, Marduk. His actual Jewish name, we don't really know. He has a name which is associated with Zoroastrian culture and Zoroastrian gods. It's like today, if if someone was called Zeus, and he would become the great rabbi in terms of a story, Zeus doesn't seem to figure. Well, Marduk is like that. But on one hand, the Torah says, okay, not only do you have to know history, not only you have to know what's going on, I'm saying history there in the past, but you know, have to know the present situation, you have to know the needs and demands of the present situation, and his ability to be part of society by his name, and by the fact, the second fact, that he was able to find out what's really going on in terms of the inner court, because he's known around the court, said so within the book. And the fact he's able to prepare his cousin, depends how you interpret the verses, but a close relative who he has adopted, and prepare her in such a way that she can win the pageant and the contest, and she becomes the hidden Jewish public wife of Achashverosh. That she's able to do that. He's able to do that as an immigrant, as an exilee. He's able to do that is an amazing story. It's the assimilationist dream. And of course, the book has... Here I'll say an interpretation of the rabbi. The book has a difficult question with this. One of the reasons given for the fast of Esther is that all people, according to the book, all the peoples participated in the feasts of Achashverosh in celebration of his conquest. And the rabbi said, those were the Jews also. And the fact that they were so happy to be assimilated into this and be part of this drunken bacchanal is considered to be the reason for the fast of Esther. What we call one of the reasons for the fast of Esther. In other words, the assimilation is not recommended to know the situation. On the other hand, it's fully accepted and understood that we need people like Mordechai to be within the council. And then, of course, since he was around the courts, he knew about the plot against the king. The only person who knows about the plot against the king is someone who's very deep into court politics. Very, very deep. You don't get this by accident. You get this by wanting to know and knowing the right people or the wrong people. So we have now the equivocal nature of assimilation. Mordechai's assimilation here seems very important. Other times it seems problematic, giving up his own, is it his wife? An adoption here, does it mean that he adopted her as a wife? Giving her up to the king's service, literal service? So this is part of the equivocal nature of what Jews can do. Or what Jews perhaps should not to do. That's why it's equivocal. And that's why we have problems with it. It's part of the edge of the story. I will come back to this as well. The Jews as a whole are basically powerless people. With whatever assimilation they've had, with whatever power they've amassed in a short period of time, it doesn't mean anything. When the king speaks with Haman, they're powerful enough that Haman can talk about them as a subversive element of society and somehow gain the king's acquiescence to this and the acquiescence of his court, and the full bureaucracy can be turned against their destruction. So they're just powerful enough to be destroyed, powerful enough to be not so noticeable, but noticeable enough to be eradicated. And the Shushan, and the capital of Shushan, is just in chaos. There's nothing really there to do. There's nothing, no way that the Jews know how to respond. The expression of those things is found in end of chapter 3, very dramatic verse, that the bureaucracy was set in effect for the eradication of the Jews. The law was promulgated in the capital city, and Jews have always moved to the capital city and to major cities in all their migrations. And the king and Haman sat down to drink after they signed all these agreements and runners were sent out. Va'ir Shushan Nevocha. The city of Shushan was in consternation. Nevocha really means running from hither to thou, to throw. And I think, of course, obviously talking about the Jews. Jews have made positions within the city. Doesn't matter. Nothing can be done. Whole story, Leo Beck writes in his diary about after Kristallnacht going down with the other heads of the community, Rabbi Leo Beck, chief rabbi of the liberal Jewish community, and highly recognized and highly honored. Great philosopher, great thinker. I mean, highly honored amongst the non-Jews. And he goes out, and he goes to every commissioner who sends him some other commissioner, to another commissioner, and he writes at the end, Nevocha. He doesn't write those words, but he says, we were from one end to the other end, and there's nothing to be done. People sent us from here to there. We're in a terrible situation. Terrible situation. And that's our situation here. What Jews maybe should do, can't do anything. Well, we know the story. We know the importance of Mordechai's earlier intervention, and the fact that history is important to writing down what took place. We know prior to that how he summons Esther, and he has to come out as a full Jew. And he has to say, a Jew needs to do what a Jew can do. You see yourself as an enslaved woman. You see yourself detached from your people. You probably don't even know what's happening. All that happened to you for up to now, which is terrible, besides all the luxury. In the eyes of the non-Jews, what happened to you might be fantastic. In the eyes of yourself as a good Jewish woman, it's a terrible tragedy. But it all was created for this moment, and the moment is not about you, and it's not about even you and me and our whatever immediate family we have left, or any immediate friends that can be bought off, that we can buy their safety off from the non-Jews. It's about the people as a whole, the entire people. And that's what it's about. And Esther, who takes charge, and Esther understands. Esther says to him, "Vatomer Esther la Shiva Mordechai." Esther says, okay, this is what he says, sends to Mordechai. They were doing this through emissaries. Lech kenos is et kol ha-yehudim ha-nimsa'im b'shushan v'tzumo lai v'al tochlu v'atishtu shloshet yomim laila v'yom gam aniv v'narotai otzum kein v'chein avol ha-melch. Go, gather together all the Jews that are here in Shushan and let them fast for me. And they should not eat and they should not drink for 3 days and nights. And I also, myself and my maidservants will also, my ladies in attendance will also fast. And so I will come to the king. In other words, the power of spirituality. And here the book affirms completely the power of spirituality. The ability to assemble large amounts of people, the ability to pray is awesome. It's awe-inducing. It is something that's also definitional as a Jew. A fantastic event, getting 300,000, or is it 500,000 Jews together to pray. Terrific. And that's part. That's the first thing Jews need to do. Historically, here I said, the first thing is they have to know the history. And by knowing the history, I mean knowing the situation at the time of what's going on. And they have to know about this. Jews always have to know this. But concurrent with this, in terms of response to situations, the spiritual response is a crucial definition according to this book. This book, and even which God's presence seems so far away that the book doesn't even mention God. But nonetheless, when we say pray, we need fasting. We understand fasting to be prayer. We understand what prayer is first to God. It's not a trance. It's not meditation. It's not mindfulness. All these things have their place. It's not therapy. It also has its place. All these things are great. It's prayer. It's beseeching God. And this is affirmed. And yesh koach to those and to communities that have people that can do such a thing. But something else takes place. We know all of what Esther is able to do. We know how she's able to put these things together. We know of that Mordechai's earlier intervention for the king. And now I can say something better. It's not just knowing the situation. It's acting the situation for on behalf of things that are proper and right. When Mordechai sticks his neck out in order to protect the king, very dangerous thing being involved in plots and counterplots. Very, very dangerous. He's able to do the right thing. In the end, it benefits the Jewish people. And Esther puts her own life on the line in a very dramatic way. And they shirk at nothing, including the false charge of attempted rape by Haman. No problem. They'll do what needs to be done. There's no shyness about this. But what then happens? They have to work through the political arena. They work because even though Haman is hung and his children are hung, we still have the major, major problem. That's the problem. The death penalty is still there. The death threat is still there. The militia of the non-Jews, the anti-Semitic militia, are there ready, and the mob's ready to destroy the Jews. And what has to take place is the very difficult defense of the Jews. Well, in my mind, and any other child that's there besides this child, any other child that's there, say, well, why don't you just have the king? Why don't you have the king do what he needs to do? And what he needs to do is just abolish that decree. Well, not all decrees can be abolished. So what can we do there? Well, what we can do is that we can have people gather themselves and be allowed to gather themselves to defend themselves. And we have a repetition of this description of the story. You see in chapter 9, for example, verse 2, the Jews gather themselves together. Oh, a wonderful line. Nikalu ha-Yehudim bar-Rehim. They gather themselves together in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Achshverosh to lay hands on such as sought their hurt. And no man could withstand them, for the fear of them fell upon all the people. They gathered themselves to defend themselves. They took their destiny into their own hands. They had prayed to God, and now with those prayers and with that resolution of spirit, they went out and they did physically and even violently, but they did what needed to be done because they know they would not be protected. Because even though this book is completely about God, it's completely about God ordering us to do what needs to be done. Jews needed to pray. They prayed. Jews needed to defend themselves. There is no exception made in this story. This is actually a really biblically true story. just as it says in the Bible about those who need to go out to defend their people. And they need to go out with the exception of those who just got married, with the exception of those who just planted a vineyard, just with the exception of those who just built a household. There's some human exceptions, but no exception is granted, the way I read this book and the way I read the Torah, or anybody can read the Torah. It's an open book. Go find it. Obligations upon everyone. And such is codified by Maimonides, that even based on the Talmud, that when it comes to a war of defense, even a chatan mechupato, even the bridegroom leaves the chuppah, and not just the bridegroom. If needed, even the kala, even the bride leaves the chuppah to go defend the Jewish people. Defend the Jewish people. That's what it says. I didn't write this. I'm glad to read it and to learn from it. And what's taken afterwards is how Jews commemorate this day. They commemorate this day in such a terrific, terrific way. They commemorate the day through social equality. Mishloach manot ish v'rayehu. You send gifts of food. Matanot levyonim, taking those who are beneath society. This is the Jewish way of response. Social unity, taking care of the disadvantaged. There's no entitlement program that's within this book. There's no entitlement program for Talmidei Chachamim, who should be revered and should be nurtured. There's no entitlement program. Yes, Jews might try to assimilate, and it won't help them. This happened in the case of the Jews. We'll still have our enemies. Jews know how to act and be part of society and for the good of general society. That's what they need to do. All Jews must do their bidding. Even Esther, no one had a bigger and better exemption for helping her people and risking her life than Esther. Cut off from her people, on her own, in a difficult palace. But you know what? Destiny is with the people. Jews need to pray. Jews need to study Torah. Jews need to have all use of their entire spiritual resources affirmed by this book. Jews need to defend themselves. They can only defend themselves by defending themselves. They can't look towards a miracle. Nowhere in this book says, stop and wait the salvation of God, and a tornado comes and knocks off all the enemies. Now you got to work through the politics, and you got to work through the bureaucracy, and then you got to work with your own hands, and that's what you need to do. There needs to be social unity. No group of Jews can think they're better than any other group. We can't think we're greater than we. I'm speaking here as a non-Haredi, cannot think I'm better than any other group, including Haredim, but the converse is equally true. We have to take care of ourselves in terms of the disadvantage. We have to take up the burden together. That's the story of Megillat Esther. We take up the burden together. I wish you all a wonderful Purim. Thank you very much, and Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Landis. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.